that is White versus USA. Shobhan.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The issue that is raised today is one that this Court has not actually addressed in a published opinion, and it raises the question of how to assess prejudice under Strickland where there is a Speedy Trial Act violation below. And our main argument on appeal before this Court is that you ought to apply the standard that the Supreme Court announced in Hill and in Flores-Ortega, which is you ought to consider whether there's a reasonable probability that, but for the erroneous advice that was, actually in this case, non-advice that was given to the petitioner, whether or not he would have gone forward and pled guilty in any event. That is, whether he has demonstrated, but for that unprofessional advice, there would not have been a guilty plea in this case. Or put another way, whether he would have insisted on the filing of the motion to dismiss, which would have resulted, almost certainly, in the dismissal of the charges in this case. And I say that because there clearly was a Speedy Trial Act violation that was established.
The government apparently concedes there was, but was there really a violation of the Speedy Trial Act?
My review of it, and I think the court's decision assumed that there was. And my review of all the orders that were entered in the case, and I submitted a summary of those, indicated that the 70-day rule was in fact violated.
By statute there are time limits imposed for these investigations of ability to stand trial and sanity. But those are not necessarily Speedy Trial Act limitations, are they?
Well, all of the time that was excluded under the Speedy Trial Act for competency evaluation and things of that nature have not been included. Those were excluded under the Speedy Trial Act. And so unexcluded days, there were more than 70 unexcluded days that went by. Whereupon, had counsel been aware of this violation, he could have filed a motion. And
there were time periods for the examinations to take place,
right?
The statute, but we've never held that if that exceeded, that necessarily cuts against the Speedy Trial Act, though, have we?
Well, the time in which the petitioner was declared incompetent has not been included in the time of the more than 70 days, so that after he was found competent again, which he was by the trial judge, there still was more than 70 days excluded under the Speedy Trial Act. And so
where does the 70 days come from?
The 70 days is in the statute itself,
I know it's in the statute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But we've never counted that. We've never used that as a limitation under the Speedy Trial Act. I know.
Well, I believe you have, and I believe that if a defendant does not go to commence trial within 70 days of his being arraignment, putting aside all the time that was excluded, that constitutes a violation of the Speedy Trial Act, and he could at that point, if he files a motion, get a dismissal of his indictment. Now, the only question is whether it would be with prejudice.
Where did he ever hold that?
I believe that that's what the statute requires, and I'm not aware of any court that says that's not what the statute requires. And so the only issue here is
we haven't granted many speedy trial violation.
No, there haven't been very many cases where the court has found a Speedy Trial Act violations, and probably a few under the constitutional standard as well.
Well, just a month ago or so, we found a Speedy Trial Act violation in Killingsworth, and then found that the dismissal should have been without prejudice.
Right. Yeah.
There's a great danger here for your position, because if we found ineffective assistance, and if we agreed with you that there and the government's concession that there is a Speedy Trial Act violation, so it goes back. Now you are allowed to withdraw your guilty plea, and the government, or your motion then to dismiss is granted, but it's a dismissal without prejudice, then the 924C count gets resurrected here, and his jeopardy is greatly increased, isn't it?
It could be.
It will be.
Well, if the 924C charge is resurrected, yeah. And if the
well, why wouldn't it be? It was part of a plea agreement, and I would think it would have to be resurrected.
Well, I think you could probably predict that the government would do that, and I think that the grand jury would return such a charge. But going to the central point you're making, I do agree that there is some risk, a substantial risk to the client, the petitioner in this case, that he could be exposed to a greater punishment as a result of that. And I have had that discussion with him on a number of occasions.
I think that's wise that you had that, and I would hope that there's something in writing saying I agree with your strategy here, because if you go back and the 924C count is put back into the case, he could get a longer sentence there.
It could happen, Judge. I'm aware of that, and I know he's aware of that as well. I think that going to the question of prejudice, all the petitioner is really seeking on that point is that the Hill standard be considered and applied, and the trial court judge never did that in this case. Instead, the trial court just decided what it would have done had it been presented with this motion, and whether it would have dismissed with or without prejudice, which isn't the relevant inquiry. And reading the government's responsive brief, I think what the government is arguing is that his dismissal without prejudice was reasonable and appropriate. But, of course, that's not the issue here. It's whether or not prejudice has been shown. And I think that not only did Mr. White submit an affidavit on his own saying that he would have certainly not gone forward with his plea and would have sought dismissal. He did it as well later after he was appointed counsel in this case. And I think as well that even on the day that he entered his guilty plea, he was extremely reluctant to plead guilty. And, in fact, the judge took a recess so that he could confer with his then trial counsel about whether he should accept what was ended up being an oral agreement with the government, not even a written agreement. And I think that history of his reluctance in the 2 years in which it took this case to be resolved by plea is another factor this court has looked to see whether there's objective circumstances which would demonstrate that a petitioner would not have pleaded guilty. And I think that also was something that went to his favor and was something that the trial judge did not consider.
Of course, the whole thing running through it is his competency in both the time plea and at the time of the offense.
That was an issue that was raised, and in fact, if when you look at the record and you ask yourself, did he really want to go to trial, one of the ways that I think you can say that he really did want to go to trial was after he was found competent. I think the government assumed, well, he was now going to plead guilty because he's been found competent. But in fact, he insisted on going to trial and was apparently going to raise an insanity defense, at which point the government asked that the judge order a third evaluation to determine whether he was sane or not at the time of the offense. That, of course, is relevant to whether or not he's guilty, but, you know, it's mostly relevant to whether or not he wanted to go to trial. If he wasn't going to go to trial and was going to say, I understood what I was doing and could provide a factual basis, had a plea, there wouldn't be any need to determine whether he was sane or not at the time of the offense. He would be acknowledging that he was sane. So I think when you look at the objective evidence, which is what this court has said you should do, in addition to what his sworn statements were, I think that he's made a demonstration of prejudice. And when you look at it under the right standard, he should get an opportunity to at least have the judge determine that whether there was ineffective assistance as a first matter, and then ultimately perhaps withdraw his plea. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Murray.
May it please the Court. My name is Tyler Murray, and I represent the United States, the appellee in this matter. I'd like to begin by sincerely apologizing to the Court for my delay. The district court resolved appellant.
Way to come, right?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Had a long way to come to get here.
Not, Judge.
But go ahead.
District Court resolved appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim on the prejudice prong. So the only question before the court was whether, had counsel filed a motion to dismiss based on a Speedy Trial Act violation, whether the outcome of the case would have been different. Now, a Speedy Trial Act violation requires dismissal. The only issue is whether the district court should dismiss with or without prejudice. So in determining whether the motion would have made any difference, the district court went on through the three factors to determine whether that dismissal would.
Let me go back and just ask you, are you satisfied that there was a speedy trial violation?
Well, I was not. Obviously, this was not raised prior to the guilty plea. The first time it was raised was during the 2255 proceedings. The government made a strategic decision not to quibble over whether or not there was a Speedy Trial Act violation, but instead argue that the dismissal should be without prejudice because, again, that puts the defendant in the same spot he would have been in prior to filing of the motion.
Well,
so,
I don't think you've taken any cognizance of the Hill case. The Hill case just says if you wouldn't have pleaded guilty, that's it. How do you deal with that?
Absolutely. Well, I think what appellant is doing here is kind of meshing the two together. Would I have pled guilty and or would I have filed a motion to dismiss? I don't see any causal connection here between whether I would have pled guilty and whether I would have moved to dismiss the indictment. Had he moved to dismiss the indictment prior to the guilty plea, as the district court said, it would have dismissed without prejudice. He's in the exact same spot he would have been in prior to entering a plea, guilty or not guilty. The case hasn't changed. There's no new witnesses, no stale evidence, no witnesses not available. He's in the exact same spot. So I don't think the whether he would or would not have pled guilty is the standard here. I think we're dealing with a standard of had the motion been filed, would the outcome of the case been different? And I think the answer there is clearly no.
Now, well, you don't think the Hill case controls him?
I do not. I do not think the issue before the court is whether or not the defendant would or would not have pled guilty. I think the issue is whether or not, had the motion been filed, the outcome of the case would have been different. And even if the outcome of the case is whether or not he would or would not have pled guilty, there's absolutely no showing of any reasonable causal connection between the filing of the motion and a guilty plea. It just simply doesn't make sense. Now, the district court went through the three factors with more than ample thoroughness, detailing the seriousness of the offense. This was a crack distribution, felony in possession, and finally, the third charge was use of a firearm in connection with distribution of crack cocaine. They considered prejudice to the defendant. There was no showing of prejudice here. Again, no missing witnesses, no stale evidence, no allegation that the proceedings were unfair. And finally, the court looked at the facts and circumstances leading to the dismissal. The defendant claimed negligence or oversight on the part of the government or the court. Significantly, there was no showing of any bad faith on the part of the government. And the defense conceded that it was also due to inattentiveness of defense counsel. So there's simply no, going through the three factors, no basis to suggest that the outcome would have been any different. Having made that analysis, the court concluded, again, because there would have been no difference, that the defendant would have been in the exact same position. So there can be no showing of actual prejudice. Therefore, the court properly denied the Section 2255 motion. If there aren't any additional questions, the court would respectfully request this court affirm that denial of the 2255 motion. Thank you.
You have 1 minute. Okay. Were you appointed in this case, Mr. Schmidt? Thank you very much for your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you.